So what is the bottom of the swamp?
Well, for the evolution question, it's the fact that DNA is a code, and that the evolution question is a question of how does code evolve? Now, that's not all of it, but that's much of it, okay? And so Brian's thing about falcons was actually getting really close to the bottom of the swamp, just the way he phrased it. He said, falcon has copying error in DNA. Copying error makes eyesight better. Falcon hunts better, out hunts the other falcons. All the falcon population improves in quality. Okay, that was actually a very clear and simple description of traditional Darwinian theory. It was by no means complete, but it got to the essence of neo-Darwinism. He described neo-Darwinism correctly. But what I had this huge epiphany. I was lost. But I knew that acoustics paper. I knew the feeling of when you finally figured something out. And one day, bam, here comes that feeling. And it was, I'm reading about DNA, mutations, how the genetic code is put together. And I'm like, wait a minute. I know this. I know exactly what this is. I've seen this before. This is layered digital code. And I wrote an Ethernet book in 2002, which is a whole nother story. But for the purposes of my career at the time, it was a really good idea to write that book. And I wrote this book, and it's how the ones and zeros go from here to there on your Wi-Fi or that blue cable that connects your computer to the internet. And I said, DNA, Ethernet, in fact, I've got a diagram I show in my presentations. You put it's in my Arizona State University prize announcement. Ethernet here, DNA transcription and translation here, they look almost identical. I'm like, oh, so this has to obey all the rules of code. I know those rules. I know about information entropy. I know about signals. I know about noise. I know about digital signal processing. I know about analog signal processing. I know about error correction and detection. Oh my word, I can do this. This makes sense now. And it was correct. Like, I had this flood of intuitions. I'm like, okay, so that probably means this is true. It probably means this is true. It probably means this is true. And over the next couple of years, one by one by one by one, I verified by reading biology papers that all my suspicions were correct. And it was like, it was maybe the biggest epiphany I've ever had in my life. When all that came together, it was like, okay, evolution is a software engineering problem. Or it can be framed that way. Now, it's more than that, certainly, but part of it is fundamentally a software engineering problem. Okay, I can figure this out. And all of a sudden, it started to line up and it started to make sense. Wow.
What did Brian think about this during this time?
Okay, so Brian is kind of, he's keeping a distance. Brian told me, he said, all right, Perry, I am going to be like a big soft pillow. Meaning when people come after me like, hey, what about this and what about that? And I want to argue with you. What Brian realized was that there wasn't any way that he could get in arguments about this with people without trying to proselytize them back the other direction. And he did not want to do that. He did not want to be that guy. He didn't want to be the guy who's taking away other people's faith.
Sure.
And frankly, he just didn't want the stress of fighting this out with all of these people. And so he just kind of deflected stuff. And I would come to him with stuff. And he would think it was interesting, but he didn't want to engage that deeply with it. So he stood on the sidelines. He did think it was interesting. And as my whole evolution thing evolved, he he thought it was definitely intriguing. But you have to remember, he's not fundamentally a scientific guy. You know, so different people sort out the world different ways. And an engineer, physicist, a scientist, a chemist is going to approach these questions much differently than a historian or housewife or a business manager or whatever. And so it's like, well, Perry's got his own way of figuring this out.
Right. So at this point, you've kind of figured the DNA is code out.
Right.
He's on the sidelines.
Yep.
The thing that has come up to my mind a couple times is when you say science, I'm going to let science make this decision for me.
Right.
Which I think is very cool and agnostic in a way. Like, I'm going to like let this,
right,
you know, these facts tell me what to do.
Right.
Do you feel like, almost speaking from like a hardcore Christian perspective, do you feel that that's a, maybe not a stance that God would want us to take?
Okay. So that's a great question. So first of all, it's a very myopic way of approaching the question. And I don't, like, technically, I don't think that's really the right way to approach the question, because I understand the limitations of science. Okay. However, because I was an engineer, I already understood the limitation of science anyway. I knew what science could and couldn't tell you. Okay, so like, science can't tell you why it's okay to eat a cow, but it's not okay to eat your office manager. Science cannot tell you whether it's okay to kill people and eat them for dinner. Okay, morality tells you that. But see, I knew that. So I don't think you can reduce all of this to just being a scientific question. I really don't. However, I knew that science could tell me, does it take a purposeful action to get a hand? Or do hands happen by accident? And the definitive answer from communication theory was, hands don't happen by accident. Codes don't happen by accident. Evolution doesn't happen by accident. And this whole thing is way deeper than anybody's talking about. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself now. But back to your question. Whether you think people should let science make this decision for them, they will and they do. That's the fact. There are millions of people who have let science make the decision for them that faith is or is not valid. And that's a fact. Deal with it, right? You can scream, you could object, you could stage a protest. People are going to do that. And that's what I did. Because I had to confine this to something I could manage. I couldn't manage 9,000 questions. And let me also mention, when you are in a state of doubt, there's a particular vulnerability that you have, and it's the mountain of 9,846 questions all at once. Okay, nobody should expect themselves to answer 9,800, you know, that nobody can answer that many questions. Nobody should expect anybody else to. Nobody should expect themselves to. And you have to remember, it takes a lot longer to answer a question than it takes to ask it. Okay? And so I've met a lot of atheists. They can pound you with 8,000 questions. What they don't realize is I know how to ask them 8,000 more questions that they don't know how to answer either. Okay? And you have to take things in finite doses. Most of these questions, good answers do exist, but it takes time to wade through them, and you have to narrow what you're thinking about to something you can manage. Okay, so, you know, there's going to be thousands of people that watch this video that are they get into various stages of doubt. You have to narrow the field to something you can manage. You can't just stand under a bucket of bricks while a bunch of skeptics throw stuff at you, because it's not fair. You have to turn the table around. It's like, okay, skeptic, you answer. You tell me how this works. And when I started digging, I started finding out the skeptics didn't have nearly as many answers as they pretended to have. I quickly figured out nobody knows where life came from. I also figured out we know at a surface level how evolution works. At a deep level, we do not. If we knew at a deep level how evolution works, our software would evolve. It doesn't. We don't know how to make machines or computer programs that do what bacteria do or do what animals do. Not even close. We don't even know how to make one self-replicating machine, even though we've been able to perfectly define what a self-replicating machine is for decades. Nobody's even made one self-replicating machine. And so, you know, this whole, the hubris around how much science we actually know is just obscene. And the litmus test for how much we know in science is engineering. If you can build it, you understand it. If you can't build it, you don't understand it. And you can take that to the bank. Oh, we completely understand protozoans. Okay, build one. Nobody's built a protozoan. Craig Venter has made synthetic cells from lots and lots of borrowed parts. He's re-engineered the DNA of existing cells. That's as far as we've gotten with bioengineering. And so you got to be really careful when you start saying, we know how stuff works and we know how things are. You can't build it. You don't understand it.
I want to jump in right here on this exact topic of not knowing. So almost coming back to the original stuff at the beginning with young earth, the creationism stuff. Is it an okay place to take a stance that, like, hey, the earth is 6,000 years old? Because they, I mean, obviously no one can build a earth.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
How does one go about proving the earth is old or young?
Well, so you end up having to do math. Okay? You end up having to make inferences using normal scientific thinking. So again, if I know that that star is 100 million light years away, and if I know that light travels at 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, then I can calculate how far away that star is. And now there's always this there's a very fundamental question. Well, are the laws of the universe constant? Is the speed of light constant? Are the laws of the universe the same 100 million light years away as they are here? Well, you can never know that for sure. But what you can say is, if the laws of science, if the laws of physics are not constant, then the whole enterprise of science itself just falls apart. The fact that all of your stuff works, the fact that the video camera is working, the fact that the USB cable works, the fact that the Voyager satellite did what the Voyager satellite, the fact that all this stuff works, again, we're back to engineering. Engineering verifies that this kind of thinking is valid. It is inferred to be valid. We don't know that it's valid. Now, if you want to reject the idea that constants are constant, that the laws of physics are consistent, if you want to reject that idea, you can do that if you so choose. But it takes you back 1,000 years in science. It takes you back to it takes you back to before we knew anything about science. And I just don't know how you can, like, how can you rely on the conveniences of the modern world and the technologies and the cell phones and everything else and the medicine, and then say that you don't believe that science can tell us anything about history? Well, we can use science to determine 10 seconds ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 hours ago, 10 weeks, years, centuries ago. Why can't we use science to determine 100 centuries ago, or 1,000 centuries ago, or 1,000,000 centuries ago? What's the problem? One of the most fundamental ideas in science is that the universe is constructed from a consistent set of unchanging laws that are discoverable and measurable. In fact, there's a verse in Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 11, which is from the Catholic Apocrypha. It's at least 2,200 years old, maybe older. It says, "Thou hast made everything in weight and number and measure." Okay, that is the first statement, to my knowledge, of a scientific worldview that ever existed on Earth. It's more precise of a statement, to my knowledge, than anything the Greeks ever came up with. And that idea got developed in the Middle Ages to, by 1300, 1400, 1500, 1600, becoming what we now understand to be modern science. And it was birthed out of theology. And again, it was based on the idea that God made an orderly world with unchanging laws that we could discover. Okay? And that idea became the unifying force that said, oh, Newton sees an apple fall out of a tree and he goes, hey, if the same thing that makes apples fall out of trees causes moons to orbit planets, then I have this unifying thing called gravity, and everything is explained by this one equation, okay, which is a huge breakthrough. You can't describe how, when you go from being in a world where everything maybe seems to happen for no reason at all, I don't know why there's a thunderstorm, I don't know why there was a meteor, I don't know why there was a comet, I don't know, like, all these things just happen, maybe Zeus and Apollo got mad at each other, like, this is the ancient world, right? When all is said, no. The reason the asteroid fell, the reason the comet went through the sky, the reason the moon orbits the Earth, the reason those two stars are circling each other, and the reason that the apple fell out of the tree is all the same reason, and you can explain it all with this one equation. That is such a massive simplification. It is so elegant. And I love the word elegant. It's elegant. It's one coherent explanation instead of a bunch of little ad hoc explanations. And this is the nature of science. Okay? And what increasingly began to bother me was Christians rejecting this very thing that Christianity itself had given birth to. Okay? Science wasn't born in Greece or Rome or China or India or the Mayas or Egypt. It falteringly tried to get started in those civilizations, but it never went anywhere. Why didn't it go anywhere? Because there wasn't a verse that said, "Thou hast made everything in weight and number and measure." But Christian theology had a conception of God, which, now, in the 1700s, this became deism. It was the idea of the watchmaker that just winds it up and lets it go. Now, a lot of Christians, they don't like this watchmaker idea. I think this watchmaker idea is almost necessary in science, okay? And maybe later in our conversation, maybe we could talk about miracles, or maybe we can talk about people's spiritual experiences, but let's just set that aside right now, okay, and understand that wherever possible, you look for regularities in nature. You look to do what Isaac Newton did, which is unify 1,000,000 disparate things with one equation, and then all of a sudden you explained all of them. That is so beautiful. It is so immensely powerful. It's beautiful. It, like, there's different things that, you know, you could look at a sunset, you could look at a cliff, you could look at the ocean, you could look at a woman's body, you could look at an athlete. Well, you know what? That kind of an equation is as beautiful as all those other things. If you have sufficient education and experience to appreciate what it really is, it's beautiful. And so I started getting the sense that in order to preserve a particular way of seeing God, that Christians were undercutting the whole entire enterprise of science itself, in order to make history fit their interpretation of Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it really started to grate on me. It's like, oh my word, like, I don't want to get too far ahead of my story here, but I have this epiphany about DNA. Like, okay, so number one, all that code in the Falcon, if the Falcon evolves, it's not through random copying errors. Now, and number two, it's code, and all the other codes are designed. And I can't find any codes that aren't designed. Well, so that would make it look like DNA is designed. So, really, at this point, now I had two questions. So one of them is, where did life come from in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there has to be a genetic code before you can have replicating cells, okay? So that sure looks like a design argument. But then there's the evolution question. And we can go in these however order you want to, but I'll just say that most people who went the path I went down would have become old earth creationists and have and do. But I wasn't so sure that evolution was wrong. I just suspected that the explanation I was being given was wrong. And those are two different things. And the reason that I suspected that evolution might still be true was because all of those emails and all of those conversations with all those people. And so what would happen, you'll notice I got a lot of books here.
Just a few.
A lot of the way I ended up getting a lot of these books is I would get in a conversation with somebody and they would say, well, you should read this book. So I would buy the book. You know, one of the advantages of having a fairly successful business at the time was I can afford these crazy experiments with this Google traffic. So, like, for years, I spent $3,000 to $5,000 a month on Google traffic. I was feeding my little apologetics machine, and it was feeding me questions, and I wanted to know, can I answer all these questions? And I'm going to put money in the slot, and I'm going to cause people to show up, and they're going to pound on my questions, and I'm going to find out the truth, and that's how I'm going to do it. In fact, I can get all these people to do a lot of work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Totally.
Right? Let your enemies figure out what the questions are. Right? And then you see if you can answer them. So I was doing that.
20 work again.
Yep. And like, I could afford to buy any book I wanted, right? It's like, okay, if I need to buy this $110 textbook, I buy it because it's my education. This is my post-college. Now, compared to what people spend on college, this is still incredibly cheap,
mm-hmm.
right? So, okay, so I'm spending $60,000 a year buying books and Google traffic. There's lots of grad students that spend $50,000 a year getting a PhD. I'm getting my informal PhD on the streets of the internet, right? So you got all these books, and I'm reading all these books, and I'm like, well, you know, the way they're explaining how evolution works isn't right. I know it's not right because communication theory tells me absolutely that it's not right. Like, I know that I know this.
Like, we're talking about like Neo-Darwinism.
Okay, so I'm talking Neo-Darwinism. So Neo-Darwinism is what Brian told me on the bus.
Okay.
Copying errors in the falcon's DNA, and occasionally when copying error makes the eyesight better instead of worse, and so then those falcons hunt better, and the other falcons die, and then the population gets better and better. If you combine that with population genetics and Mendel and a few other things, you have Neo-Darwinism, which is basically the theory du jour of the 30s and 40s, which became cemented into modern biology. And so this was the explanation. Accidental mutations, random selection, everything gets better and better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, but this is digital code. Now, here's what they're really telling you. Now, this sounds all believable to most people, or to a lot of people anyway, but let me give you an analogy of what they're actually saying. So let's say that we buy a CD. We buy Boy by U2, 1980, or whatever year that was, right? And we have the CD. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to replicate CDs. We're going to get a CD stamping machine, and we're going to make CDs, except every CD is going to have a scratch somewhere, which corrupts a little bit of the data, and the scratch is going to be in some random place. Every single one is different. So we make a million CDs with scratches,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we replicate those million CDs. But the ones with detrimental scratches get thrown away, and the ones with beneficial scratches we keep. Now, that is an exact analogy to what Neo-Darwinism is saying. Well, guess what? If you scratch a CD, it always, always, always makes it worse. It never makes it better. If you corrupt an internet packet, it always makes it worse. If you corrupt a USB stick, it makes it worse. If you corrupt an SD card, it makes it worse. It never makes it better. Copying errors do not improve anything.
Hmm.
Okay? Ever. And as an author of an Ethernet book, I can absolutely assure you this is true. And Ethernet and computers and cell phones and all of these devices, they have myriads of error detection and error correction systems. And when you're driving down the expressway and your daughter's in the back seat with her iPad and she's watching Dora the Explorer on YouTube or something, and you don't even know it, but there's all these, hey, that packet didn't come right. Fix that packet. Send me another one. There's all this stuff going on between the iPad and the cell phone tower to make all that come out right. And every single one and zero has to come in correctly, or else the whole thing just blows up. And it turns out cells are the same way. And just like Ethernet hubs and switches and iPads and cell phones, cells have error detection systems. Cells have error correction systems. And as soon as I had this epiphany, I suspected it would be true. And then I later found out it was true. And I eventually found out, actually, evolution does not work the way the Neo-Darwinists say it does. It works a different way. But it happens. And so...
And what would you say? How does it work?
Okay. So in order to explain this, let me tell you another story. So for about 2 years, I've got all these emails coming in, and I'm going, this explanation of evolution doesn't make sense, but I've got all these books and all this anecdotal evidence. It sure looks like evolution still happened anyway. So how? And I didn't know. But I, for some reason, I just was wise enough, I guess, to just let the question float. Also, I decided pretty early on that how evolution works, or the degree of evolution, or the role of evolution in the history of Earth, is not a central issue in Christianity. Like, if there's a hill you're going to die on, that is not one of the ones that you should die on.
Hmm.
It is not even central, like whether animals or kinds and whether dogs and cats could come from a common ancestor. I don't think the Bible addresses that in the slightest. I don't think the biblical authors were even remotely concerned with questions like that. I think it's a huge mistake to insert some kind of biblical doctrine into that entire question. Did dogs and cats have a common ancestor? The Bible doesn't care, okay? The Bible doesn't give you any kind of precise definition about any of this, okay? What does the Bible say about animals, by the way? It says they came from the ground. It says, let the ground produce animals and crawling things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not a very precise... And by the way, it doesn't say God just made the crawling things. It says the ground produced them.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, the Genesis story, at least in some roundabout, oblique way, might even seem to suggest evolution, quite frankly. Okay? It says, let the waters be filled with... let the waters teem with fish. And it doesn't say anything about how they came to be, okay? Again, I don't think they're even concerned with the question. So I think Christians that turn this into a doctrine are just making a huge legalistic blunder. It's a huge mistake. They're just importing all this baggage. It's like saying, well, it's wrong for a pastor to take his wife to a psychiatrist. I mean, it's so inappropriate. Well, anyway, for a couple years, I just said, I'm going to stay neutral about this. This is not a hill I'm going to die on. I'm not going to deal with that. But I'm going to accumulate evidence, and I'm going to keep reading books. So I'm like, looks like it happened, not sure how. One day, somebody sends me a paper. It's by James Shapiro. Well, James Shapiro is a highly regarded geneticist at the University of Chicago. And he tells the story about a woman named Barbara McClintock. And he was friends with and colleagues with Barbara for a long time, and she was a mentor to him. Barbara, I think Barbara is the most important biologist of the 20th century. That's a big statement. Yeah. I think so, okay? In the 1940s, she was doing experiments with corn. And she would blast corn with doses of radiation, and it would break the chromosomes of the DNA, and then she would see what happened. And they didn't understand DNA at the time. It hadn't specifically been discovered, but geneticists could look in a microscope, and they could look at chromosomes, and they could see things that were going on. She was very good with a microscope, and she was extremely acutely aware of what was going on with her plants. And she would look at ears of corn, and she would figure out from the patterns of the corn kernels, you know, the dark ones and the light ones, she would actually figure out how the chromosomes had changed. Okay, it was absolutely brilliant what she did. So Barbara McClintock is hacking corn plants, and she throws the plant a curveball, and the plant just throws a curveball right back at her. And she's like, whoa, what is going on here? And she pieced together very carefully. She figured out what happened. And what happened was that she broke a chromosome, and the plant wasn't able to reproduce properly. But the plant wanted to reproduce. And so what the plant did was, using transposable elements, which are segments of DNA that can move around, and moving a transposon is sort of like moving an adverb or an adjective to a different part of the sentence and making your sentence say something different, right? So this plant was taking pieces of DNA from other sections and other chromosomes and copying them over here. It constructed a unique new sequence that had never existed before, repaired the chromosome, and went on and reproduced. And she figured out exactly what had happened. All these different genes and bits of chromosomes, she figured this out. And She presented this at a conference at Cold Spring Harbor, New York in 1951. And their reaction from the audience was a mix of anger and, like, you got to be crazy. Like, some of them thought it was funny. Like, woman, you don't seem to know. Genetics builds the plant. The plant doesn't build the genetics. Don't you know this? Okay? And, like, half of them were just angry. Like, who does she think she is? Like, plants don't do this. She just spent the last 7 years meticulously figuring out this is what had happened. And she called these things jumping genes or transposons, transposable elements. Well, everybody ignored her. They wouldn't listen. Well, turns out she was the first person to observe an evolutionary event and also figure out the genetics of how it had done it. So you could make an analogy. It would be like she ripped, if I ripped a page out of a mystery novel and I gave it to a good writer and I said, okay, read everything before that page, everything after that page, and reconstruct what you think that page is missing, a good writer could do it. And, you know, they might take stuff from this chapter and sentences from over here and, you know, beg, borrow, steal from the rest of the book and piece it together. Well, that's what the plant did. Like, a corn plant knows how to rearrange its own DNA. Well, this is like that M.C. Escher drawing where the hand is drawing a hand is drawing a hand. I mean,
right.
This is really trippy.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, if you just stop and think about it, okay, so, well, right. So the genes and chromosomes, they build the plant, but then if they get damaged, the plant rebuilds the genes and chromosomes in a unique way. Well, so here's what happens. Everybody ignores her. Nobody believes her. So she goes underground with her research. And basically, she didn't publish her work for 20 years, but she kept doing it.
Okay.
Well, in the 70s, people started seeing this other places. And then she started publishing, and she won the Nobel Prize in 1983 for discovering transposable elements. Well, transposable elements are part of the bread and butter of genetics, okay? Well, so Shapiro's talking about this, and then he goes on and he's explaining the error detection systems, the error correction systems, and how when cells go through these stages of repair, and every time a cell in your body copies, there's this error checking system that happens. And like, okay, that didn't copyright, fix it. That didn't copyright, fix it. Which is exactly what happens when your kid is in the back seat and there's engine noise and there's radio towers and there's all this stuff going on, but you're still getting the signal. It's the same thing. In fact, a lot of the mathematics is the same. You could go and we don't have, this is way too deep for this video, but I mean, we could go to different forms of error detection, error correction that exist in Ethernet and stuff, and it's almost the same. It's scary how similar it all is. And Dr. Shapiro is talking about how a cell is kind of like an operating system, and it cleans up files, and it does all these things to maintain itself. And I'm like, how come nobody is talking about this? So first of all, Shapiro and his friends and the citations and the other papers he cites and McClintock, it turns out there's this whole entire community of people doing live evolution experiments, just like Barbara did. And the science had advanced hugely since Barbara's time, because now we're in the early 2000s and I'm reading this paper. And Jerry Coyne isn't talking about it, and Richard Dawkins isn't talking about it, and Ken Ham's not talking about it, and the Discovery Institute and the Intelligent Design guys aren't talking about it. They're proving evolution happens in real time, which I haven't even gotten into yet. They make new species. They do symbiotic mergers. They do hybrids, massive rearrangements of DNA. like, from an engineer's point of view, the stuff is just astonishing. The intelligent design guys aren't talking about it. The creationists aren't talking about it. The Darwinists aren't talking about it. It's like, I've been buying books for 2 years and nobody's told me this. How is this possible? And I dig deeper and there's more. And I dig deeper and there's more. I find out about Lynn Margulis, and I find out about David Prescott, and I find out about Evelyn Witkin and all of these people, and they've been proving this stuff for decades. But they're like the redheaded stepchildren of biology. And I'm like, you'd think the Christians would be talking about this stuff. They're not. They're like, evolution, bad, bad, bad. It's like, no, evolution, amazing, amazing. It's happening in petri dishes right now. It's why you have to finish your antibiotics. Why aren't you guys talking about this? So, Creation Research Science Quarterly chastises me for not knowing that all of their guys have been talking about this at their conferences for years. Well, I'm not the only one that doesn't know. Like, how come you guys are keeping this stuff a secret? And how come you're not explaining how evolution works? So let's run with the creationist young earth view of the world for a little while. So the creationists tell you, it's like, I remember this whole explanation that, well, the earth was enveloped in water, and the water kept the sunlight from coming through, so that meant people lived for 1,000 years, and then the water came down, and that was the flood, and it wiped out the whole earth, and all the species of the earth were on one ark, and because it was a global flood, and then, you know, and so you have this whole story. Well, we don't have geological evidence for a global flood. We have a lot of geological evidence for a massive regional flood in the Middle East about 5,000 years ago. Hmm. And we have 200 civilizations that have an arc story, okay? And clearly something like that happened. And I do think Noah is a historical person and stuff, but geology and history do not confirm a global worldwide flood. But let's grant for a second, let's go with a global worldwide flood. Well, that means all the animals on Earth have to have fit on an ark 5,000 years ago, right? Sure. Okay. All right. So my numbers might be a little off, but let's just say we've got 10 million species now and we had 10,000 on the ark. That's 1,000,000 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wait, 10 million, 10,000. Sorry, it's 1,000 to 1. 1,000 to 1 species. So for every species you have in the ark then, you have 1,000 species now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of evolution. A lot. So if we just take, if we take a young earth creationist story at face value, which I don't believe that all of the animals on the earth were on Noah's Ark. I think their cattle and their stuff was, but, you know, anyway. If I go with their story requires massive speciation, massive evolution, not microevolution, like macroevolution. Okay, if you're
not just like transposing genes or
massive evolution. We're, if even if you're talking 100x in the species, it's massive evolution. So why aren't they waving the evolution flag and telling everybody how evolution works and why it's necessary?
Hmm.
No, they're just machine gunning the Darwinists, telling, no, evolution is a hoax. Okay. Type in evolution is a hoax, quote unquote, in Google and see how many websites come up. Okay? And, you know, right to this very day, you go to Answers in Genesis, they're all telling you about how, you know, Darwin and everybody is this big, fraudulent, secular, you know, crusade against Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look. if Microsoft, did you ever use DOS?
I remember DOS. I never used it.
Okay. Well, yeah, most people, anybody my age, used DOS back in the day. So remember, you know, DEL file name or, you know, all these little things you type into DOS. So imagine that DOS was introduced in 1981 by Bill Gates and his friends. And imagine that no human being in Redmond, Washington ever touched it.
Okay.
And imagine that DOS added a Windows desktop by its own internal adaptations. And imagine that it added Microsoft Word, and it added Excel, and it added a web browser, and it added a connection for a mouse, and it added antivirus. And imagine that the antivirus software all talked to each other and they updated all the time. Imagine that that happened and we got to now and we got Windows 10 and nobody, no employees in Redmond, Washington ever had to touch Windows. If DOS evolved into the modern version of Windows all by itself, would you be impressed?
I would definitely be.
You would be crapping your pants. You'd be like, how on earth? I want to talk to that Bill Gates guy. I want to understand. Yeah. Right? This is how Christians should view evolution. Mm-hmm. And it just baffles me. Like, how have Christians allowed this to turn evolution to turn into a war between science and religion?
Yeah, that's the big thing that I keep noticing is like there's two factions almost, and it's almost like both of them are waging war when in fact there should be more of a union.
It's the Palestinians and the, you know, the Israelis. It's the Hatfields and the McCoys. It's the Republic against Northern Ireland. Like it's this blood sport thing. It's a grudge match. Hmm. And it's not helping. It's not helping at all. And especially considering the science itself. Like, organisms do the most amazing things. And evolution's not a hoax. Evolutionary events are produced every single day. New species, symbiotic mergers, hybrids, massive rearrangements.